From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer, and this is Environmental Connections. Today's Environmental Connection begins with hope and doom, a duality at the heart of modern climate discourse. Picture this, it's another record-breaking hot day. Perhaps not where you are, but somewhere on this increasingly warming globe. The latest headlines, they don't just forecast the weather, they forecast our future. Rising sea levels, unprecedented wildfires, devastating droughts. It's enough to make anyone feel a sense of doom. And yet, amidst these dire warnings, there is a growing narrative of hope. Innovations in renewable energy, large-scale conservation efforts, and international agreements that aim to rewrite our environmental legacy. But can these sparks of hope outshine the looming cloud of the climate crisis? Today, we're delving into this tension between the hope of what we can achieve and the doom of what might be if we fail. We'll explore not just the impacts of our actions, but also the psychology behind our responses to climate change. Recent surveys reveal a startling perspective among the youth. Many people believe they're inheriting a world doomed by previous generations' mistakes. They're growing up with a climate legacy framed by fear, not promise. And yet, this generation is also at the forefront of demanding and creating change, proving that where there's a will to fight for the planet, there is a beacon of hope. Today's esteemed guest is lauded New York Times journalist David Wallace Wells, author of the number one New York Times best-selling book, The Uninhabitable Earth, which is a stark portrayal of our possible future shaped by climate change. David brings a perspective that balances the edge of climate realism with the potential for meaningful action. As we navigate the complexities of climate change together, let's discover whether the scales can tip towards sustainability or if we're teetering too close to the point of no return. So let's turn to David to help us understand how deep the waters could get and where we might find the life rafts that we desperately need. David, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to Environmental Connections.
Really good to be here and really good to be talking about all of this.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. And for our listeners, some other exciting news. David is going to be a featured speaker at Monroe Community College on May 1st at 7 p.m. WXXI is a media sponsor and tickets are available to the general public. Okay, so David, you have been a leading voice in articulating the urgent and multifaceted impacts of climate change. Now, I don't want to get into all of the details off the bat, but for those of you who aren't familiar with what David has to say on the topic, David, I'm wondering if you can give us an idea of your 50,000 foot high view.
From the really big picture perspective, the planet's already warmer than it has ever been in the entire history of human civilization. And that means that an awful lot that we have come to take for granted as part of that civilization is under some amount of threat. Probably we'll have to reconsider what of the world we now live in today can continue as it is, what will have to be renovated and reformed, and what will have to be discarded. And that's just at the temperature level that we're at today, which is about 1.1, 1.2 degrees warmer than it was before the Industrial Revolution. We're expecting things to continue warming from there. Exactly how much, we don't know, but we're rapidly losing the opportunity to stabilize the world's climate at temperature levels that we had hoped to achieve 5 or 10 years ago with measures like the Paris Agreement, where we had hoped to limit warming to 1.5 degrees or in a kind of a backstop way, 2 degrees. Personally, I think that more optimistic goal of about 1.5 degrees is functionally lost at this point, but we still have some outside chance at keeping temperatures below 2 degrees. And every tenth of a degree, certainly every half of a degree, makes an enormous amount of difference to the amount of human suffering and human flourishing that we'll see on the planet in the head. But whatever we do, whatever action we take, however fully we renovate our lives in minimizing the amount of damage, we're going to be living in a transformed world. It'll be transformed in part by climate impacts and transformed in part by the actions we take. So what we're talking about is designing a new future, ideally one that is more resilient, more just, more equitable, and also more stable and more safe. But, you know, the matter is up to us, and we may well find ourselves stumbling into a more jagged future instead.
Okay, well, there are so many things that you just said that I want to pick apart a little bit. Now, you have described, including right now a little bit, the speed of climate change as worse than many perceive it is. Now, I know it's early in our chat, but let's start with that big one. How can we change public perception to better reflect this urgency?
Well, I'm not sure is the honest answer. It seems very, very complicated. I think 5 or 10 years ago, it was a relatively common feeling among climate activists that once we saw some really large climate impacts, that the world would wake up and that we would have lost an opportunity to take action ahead of time, but we would nevertheless be, you know, moved at scale towards political action by really, really visible, undeniable climate disasters and climate disruptions. And I think over that period, over the last 5 or 10 years, we've started to see those disasters and those disruptions. We saw just this past year, we saw the deadliest wildfire in North American history in Maui. We saw the deadliest wildfire in South American history in Chile. We saw the these incredibly large fires burning in Canada, so large that half the world's countries could fit inside the burn scar. We've seen this winter, it's the summer down there, but winter for us, fires in Australia that are 8 times as large as the famous Black summer fires from 2019, 2020. So even just looking at the fire impacts, which is just one of many, many impacts, we're seeing these really, really remarkable, indeed on the scale of sort of human lifetimes, unprecedented climate disruptions and disasters. And unfortunately, I think the public, they note some of these impacts, they marvel at them a little bit, but mostly they move on from them and start to treat even those unthinkable, unprecedented disasters as a kind of a background noise to their normal lives. And so I'm not sure if that confidence that we may have had 5 or 10 years ago is really being borne out here. I think it's it seems more to be the case that even in a world defined ever more by climate impacts, we're finding more more innovative ways of normalizing those disasters and to some extent looking away from them. That's not to say that nobody cares about climate change. You know, public concern is growing, public alarm is growing, and there's been an incredible awakening of political activism around climate over the last 5 years in particular, which has really changed a lot of the political discourse too. So, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, climate denial was a pretty big thing among global leaders. And now it's hard to find even a single one who's really a true climate denier. They may not want to take it seriously, they may not want to take action, but they all talk about it as a real thing and even a real problem. Many of them talk about it even in existential terms. We've seen massive investments in green energy all around the world, EVs and transportation technologies. These are, you know, the uptake here is really quite rapid, much more rapid than many people forecast a few years ago. And so as you said at the top, as we are, you know, sleepwalking into a world that is defined ever more by climate disruption, we are also racing towards a green transition at the same time. And we're not doing enough fast enough to really allow ourselves a path to what we would have once considered a stable and comfortable climate. But we're still doing a lot more than I think most people expected to see just a few years ago. And so that's, for me, the psychological, political, cultural, and communication challenge of the moment is how do we wrap our heads around these two sets of facts at once? The climate is behaving in unprecedented ways, presenting unprecedented challenges, and we are responding at an unprecedented speed. You know, do we think of this, do we take these two sets of facts together and think things are going okay? Do we take them together and think things are going poorly? It's really both. And we may feel different ways at different times as we reckon with different parts of the problem. But unfortunately, we're going to be living in that kind of a future for the rest of our lives, defined both by the negative impacts and the positive transformations. And ultimately, I guess where I come down is that climate change doesn't really care all that much about how we feel, how I feel, or how you feel. The important thing is what's happening, what damage it's doing, what suffering it's imposing, and what humans are doing to respond, and what more humans could be doing if more people like us devoted our lives, or at least our votes, to making sure that happened.
And on a personal level, my wife and I moved here from Los Angeles because of climate change. And there were wildfires like lapping in the background as we were driving out of town. And now we live in Western New York, which for many is a climate haven. And of course, those wildfires in Canada that you spoke about, they certainly impacted the Rochester area last year, making it very clear that not any area is fully climate safe. But I want to go back to what you're talking about these catastrophic scenarios that you're pointing to, including social and economic impacts. How should these be influencing current global policies and international relations in ways that they currently aren't?
Well, I think there's been a sort of a conceptual sea change in the way that economists and indeed to some degree policymakers all around the world have thought about these issues over the last 5 years. And I think that's one reason why we are seeing significantly more global investment and a faster rollout of renewables than we might have expected, which is to say, you know, in this sort of Al Gore era, people in rich countries in the world may have thought we need to do something about climate change for moral reasons, for ethical reasons, to protect people who in poorer parts of the world and to protect future generations. But that's going to be a difficult challenge. It's going to be an expensive challenge. It's going to be burdensome. It's going to mean additional costs. Even a few years ago, you know, Bill Gates' climate book talked a lot of, in his climate book, he talked a lot about what he called the green premium, which is to say how much more expensive it would be to go green than to continue using the, especially the power systems, but also our agricultural industrial infrastructure systems that give rise to carbon emissions and therefore climate change. And that was the sort of conventional wisdom not long ago. A more resilient, climate responsible path would be expensive. And that's, I think, one reason why we were relatively slow to follow that path, because a lot of people thought, I don't want my energy bills to go up. I don't want my economy to be growing more slowly. These things are, you know, pressing and imminent needs of mine more than concern for the world's state 20, 30, 50, 70, 200, 500 years from now, which are the kind of timelines that climate change makes you think on. But because there's been this incredible transformation in the price of renewable energy in particular over the last decade, with the price of wind and solar falling by 80, 90%, the price of batteries falling similarly, such that now in 90%+ of the world, it's cheaper to build new green energy than continue running dirty energy. This has all meant that anyone who's sort of drawing the climate future or indeed the political or economic future of the world on a whiteboard and trying to say, here's where we should be going if we're optimal way, they're now seeing that that optimal path is the green path. And the dirty path is actually the path of greater impoverishment and indeed quite a lot of public health suffering on top of that. You know, estimates today are that at least 5 million people are dying every year from the air pollution produced from the burning of fossil fuels globally. And even in the U.S., where we have relatively clean air, something as on the order of 350,000 Americans are dying every year from that air pollution, which is about as many people as died in the first year of COVID in the US. So we're talking about an annual public health burden from our use of fossil fuels that is absolutely enormous. And we now see a path where we can avoid that. We can go green, electrify our power and transportation systems, and also add significantly to our pace of economic growth and activity for a number of reasons, including that doing so will mean generating a sort of a new industrial revolution, a new green industrial revolution, and all of the investment and job creation that brings with it. Now, I think that's all of those, that bundle of facts and ideas and observations is a quite compelling pitch to people who may have a more pocketbook view of their future and their own set of concerns about it, which is to say, this is not a project we need to undertake because we are high-minded, moralistic, tree-hugging lefties. This is also what we would want to do if we were taking an incredibly cynical, cold, clear-eyed, bottom line assessment of where we're going to net out in a dollars and cents way 10 or 20 years from now. Do we want to be on a path of greater prosperity and more, more comfortable public health? Or do we want to be on a path of less prosperity and more intense public health suffering? I think the answer there is going to be pretty clear to almost anyone who's looking soberly and clearly at the data. And I do think to this point, the history of climate activism has probably or possibly underplayed, underemphasized that set of messages in trying to rally support for the cause, And we probably could do a better job of that going forward. In particular, I think about the public health issues and the public health benefits, which very few people are aware of, and they're so large that you really can't deny them or argue with them when you're presented with them.
And yet, there are plenty of people who do, right? And I'm sure that from your perspective, that must be like unbelievably frustrating. And for a lot of our listeners too, who are just trying to do something, trying to do the best they can to awaken other people to what's going on with climate change. So regarding that impact of getting involved with policy work in order to address climate change, do you feel that it's only effective when it's on a national level, or are there things that can be done on a local level that you think are impactful?
Absolutely. In a lot of ways, local policy advocacy can be more effective because the obstacles are smaller and less organized and less well-financed. It's, you know, at the moment, we're now in America dealing with the aftermath of this large piece of climate legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, that was passed about a year and a half ago now. And seeing how that money, which is a really, really large scale investment, much, much larger than the US has ever made before on green energy and decarbonization, how that investment is actually shaking out and being spent on the ground. And that is being determined by local factors much more than by national factors. I mean, the federal government has set these tax incentives, they've set some regulations and policies, but you know, whether a transmission line gets built or whether a large solar farm is built, or whether there's opposition to those projects at the local level is, again, being determined by those communities and whether they're supportive of those projects or the opposite. The same is true in the public sector with local environmental policy. You know, again, these are leaders who interface with their constituents in a much more direct way. They are therefore, at least should be, much more responsive to local voices. And that means that there's a sort of a more leverage when you're talking about these impacts or trying to have an impact at the local level than at the national level. A national vote, a vote for president is really important. This fall is like a really big election for the kind of climate course of the country, as that almost goes without saying. But even regardless of what happens in November, we're going to be figuring out a lot of this. We're going to be spending a lot of this money. We're going to be determining whether and using what standards we are making those investments. And a lot of that is going to be shaped at the state and local level, not just the federal one. So I think, you know, there's a place for action up and down the sort of the climate food chain. And starting with at the very smallest level, just the act of climate communication that you can engage with the people around you, whether or not you're even organizing or planning on calling a local representative, a state senator, a mayor, council person, whatever. Simply talking about your concerns, I think, is the sort of smallest building block of political action. And many surveys show that a huge number of Americans carry around climate anxiety without really sharing it with those around them, which means that we're all pulled into a place where we believe that we care about this more than the people around us. And in fact, other polling shows that that's not really true, that in fact, we systematically underestimate how much concern, not just those closest to us have about climate change, but the country as a whole, that the country as a whole is much more supportive of climate action and much more concerned about what would happen in the climate action than almost any American really believes to be the case. So we've been sort of led to believe for a variety of reasons, or we've allowed ourselves to believe for a variety of reasons, that we are all lonely in our climate anxiety and climate, feelings of climate urgency, when in fact, the more we talk about it, the more we learn there are people who feel the same way or even more intensely all around us, which is an opportunity for political action and organization to be sure, but even just at a sort of psychological, emotional level, a feeling of communion and solidarity and support is really, really important as you're facing what can often seem like an intimidatingly large political problem.
So you brought up a few things relating to the political climate right now. I just have a couple more questions on that. What more do you feel that the Biden administration should be doing that it isn't?
Well, you know, in the really big picture, in a universe in which political action was sort of unencumbered by political reality, I would like to see a lot more what are called supply side constraints on the use of fossil fuel. So the IRA was, as I said, an enormous bill. I mean, it was officially budgeted by the Congressional Budget Office as $369 billion, but it's likely to end up being at least twice as expensive in the end, just because these are untapped tax credits. So when people claim them, the government pays you. And if you claim more of them, the government pays you more. So the faster and larger the green transition is, the bigger this bill will actually end up being. It's an enormous bill. But it's almost all on that sort of carrot side, on that incentive side, and very little on that stick side, on the regulation and punishment side. There are a couple little things in there. There's a thing about methane that is a regulatory thing. But, you know, in general, we have a challenge when it comes to climate because we are continuing to produce fossil fuel emissions. That's true at the global level, and it's true at the American level. We are seeing really impressive and inspiring rollout of renewables, but even incredibly large-scale rollout of renewables is only beginning to dent our, at the global level, the amount of fossil fuels that we're using. And if we, you know, it doesn't matter if we have 50 times as many renewables as we have today, but we're still burning the same number of fossil fuels, we're going to be doing as much damage to the planet's climate future as we are doing today. In order to start limiting that damage and ultimately get it down to zero, we need to really rapidly draw down our use of fossil fuels. And I think that the Biden administration, but really governments all around the world, could be doing much more to address that production and supply side of the equation, not just the trying to affect whether American consumers can afford an EV more easily, which is the kind of approach that they've taken to this point. And, you know, there are a lot of levers that are to some degree available to the Biden administration, even in the political context in which we live. So, for instance, they recently announced a pause on the approval of liquid natural gas exports, which had been sort of planned in the near future. Going to do a systematic review to see just how environmentally damaging those projects would be, potentially would approve them down the line if the reviews sort of point in the right direction. But my expectation would be that if Joe Biden is the president and has a second term, that they will not be going forward. And as a result, we will be, as a country, producing considerably less liquefied natural gas than we would be if those happens. And I think that that kind of approach, that kind of regulatory tool, that kind of administrative action is available on a whole wider range of fossil fuel production. And I'd like to see this government and indeed governments around the world doing much more of that. Because I think if we leave it to the market, even if we're trying to shape the market through tax incentives, we are going to get action. We are going to get a transition. We're going to see an energy transformation, but it's going to be considerably slower than, you know, the timelines that the climate is sort of screaming at us we have to hit.
Okay, well, there is a lot to consider in terms of the policy. And as you mentioned, this is a huge year. So would you say there is one single most important thing that people can support on a policy level?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, at this point, I don't want to sound like too much of a partisan, but I would say that heading into this fall, you know, which party is in control of the White House is the most important determinant of the path of climate action. Donald Trump has produced a plan, a governing agenda that involves a war on not just the IRA, Joe Biden's big climate bill, but many, many other climate measures that have been instituted and instantiated in the American administrative state, some of them for many decades. We have a Supreme Court that is friendly to that kind of attack on environmental regulation. And so the combination of, you know, a Donald Trump, Republican control of the White House, and the Supreme Court we have, I think would be really, really concerning for, you know, for those who really worry about the climate. And so ultimately, I think, you know, the sort of partisan control of the White House and the administrative state is probably, in the executive branch, is probably the most important thing for anyone to be thinking about at the moment. That all said, you know, I don't want to suggest that our whole decarbonization project sort of lives or dies on the basis of what happens on one Tuesday in November. And I do think that we've seen over the last few years really quite significant shifts in the energy politics of the green transition, particularly in quite red parts of the country like Texas and the Big Sky states, which have actually led the country in renewable rollout in recent years for a number of reasons, complicated reasons, but we're not seeing that, you know, green energy is just a concern of California and New York. In fact, you know, Texas, Wyoming, the Dakotas, these are really big players here. And I suspect that even if, you know, we get Donald Trump in the White House, and even if he does go to war on the EPA, a lot of that, you know, energy transition would still continue to unfold, even in those red states. And I think that in part because we've already seen challenges, local challenges to those pathways. In Texas, a year and a half ago, there was an effort by state legislators to kneecap the renewable industry. And then other Republican legislators were saying, actually, no, if we do that, this will be really bad for our customers. They're going to have more blackouts. Their energy prices will be higher. Like, I thought we were the free market guys. Like, let's let the market decide rather than trying to undermine this transition that's underway. And as a result, that effort to undermine the green transition in Texas failed. And we've seen in the 18 months since an even more dramatic rollout of renewables than the state had seen in the years prior. So, you know, we're the energy transition there is far enough along now that we see enough stakeholders, even in places that we think of culturally as resistant to climate action, that I think even if at the very highest level the government is taking a hostile stand, I think we're not likely to be in a kind of all hope is lost position. We're likely to be in a position where we're frustrated, where we see setbacks, but we also see some signs of progress in spite of that opposition.
And what about COP28, which of course is the UN climate change conference, most recently held last December? How would you say they're falling short?
Well, on some level, one question is, you know, what's the job of this conference? When it was founded now over 30 years ago, it was founded to organize a set of goals and principles around which national governments could take individual action. They could understand the likely path that their peer countries and sometimes rivals would be taking. They could understand what the science demanded of them in terms of climate action and make investments and policy choices on their own in that context. And we have basically seen that. I mean, I think over the last, since the Paris Agreement, you know, we've seen a global conviction that these targets are really worth pursuing, 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees. You know, in 2012, that would have been real news. You know, the climate governments around the world in 2012 were not themselves talking about the need to stay below 2 degrees. And now every time we hear reports of how far short we're falling as a world or as national governments or state governments or corporations, it's against this standard that was set at the COP conferences of you know, being sure to stay below 2 degrees and trying to keep as close as possible to 1.5 degrees. So we've already kind of internalized those benchmarks and have accelerated a lot of action and investment as a result of internalizing those benchmarks. And I think that's really meaningful progress. But we're at a place now where most of the action is not at the conference. It's not in those negotiations. And that's for a number of reasons. But one of them is the point I was making earlier, which is that the economics of a green transition have their own logic of acceleration. And whether particular national governments are moving quickly or slowly, they're doing that because of calculus that they're making about their own self-interest, not out of a sense of duty towards one another or the planet as a whole. Now, you could see that as a sort of a moral failing or, that we've lost some sense of collective greater purpose if we're not moving in unison together. And I think that that's absolutely true. And we should actually talk a lot more and think a lot more about what climate demands of us in terms of our obligations to other people around the world. But nevertheless, it means that whether we're going 60 down that highway of decarbonization or 40 down that highway of decarbonization has less to do with what was agreed upon at the last COP than it has to do with how a particular government sees the opportunities for themselves within their own country. And ultimately, that's sort of how this thing was supposed to work in the first place. It was not meant to be, you know, a shadow world government with a punitive, you know, arm for those who are falling short. It was just meant to sort of give us the standards and then let us run at the targets ourselves. Now, whether we need something more than that, I think the science says we do. I think that no government in the world is really moving fast enough to meet those targets, or very few are. And know exactly how we get to a place where we can force the action without, you know, without getting in some really quite ugly territory diplomatically, geopolitically. And I certainly don't think it would be, you know, if like the UN wants to start sanctioning countries for moving too slowly, I think that would produce, you know, quite a bit of backlash. So we're already seeing to some degree other geopolitical alliances among like-minded countries imposing something like climate tariffs, climate border taxes, as a way of sort of rewarding, you know, other countries who are moving quickly and theoretically incentivizing countries who are not. But at the same time, we're seeing, you know, tariffs being instituted and trade wars being initiated that somewhat work in the other direction. So, you know, in the last year or so, the U.S. has actually intensified its measures to, you know, engage in trade protectionism against China and China's green industrial activity. And, you know, climate advocates within the Biden administration describe this as necessary so that the U.S. can build up its own industrial capacity so that we could be building solar panels and we can be building EVs. And that's probably to some degree true. But at the moment, China is responsible for at least 80% of the global production of the 11 most important inputs to the green transition. And if America's instituting trade policies that make it harder for us to buy those solar panels, and maybe even make it harder for people in allied countries to buy those solar panels, that's actually going to slow the green transition, not accelerate it. So I think we're in a complicated place where, you know, we're not just talking about climate change in the abstract or negotiating climate diplomacy for 30, 50 years down the road. We're in a kind of a brass tacks moment where the speed is being determined by intuitions of self-interest at the national level. And some of those are not primarily calculations about climate impacts, but about other geopolitical rivalries. And, you know, ultimately, as with anything in global politics, those rivalries can get in the way of cooperation and ultimately interfere with what I think most people in the world would see as progress.
If you're just tuning in, this is David Wallace Wells, author of The Uninhabitable Earth. And David, it's interesting to hear you say China, because I recently received a letter from a listener who said, what is the point of doing anything when China is creating so many greenhouse gases? And as you mentioned, of note, the U.S. has historically emitted more carbon than any other country on the globe. So is China making progress, more progress than we are?
It depends how you want to think about it. But, you know, certainly in terms of providing green energy, they are not just doing better than we are. They're doing better than everybody is. Half of all of the renewables that were installed last year were installed in China. Two-thirds of all the EVs sold last year anywhere in the world were sold in China. And they're a country that is still burning a lot of coal. In fact, they're still opening up new coal plants. They're funding coal in other countries. This is, you know, all falls on the bad side of the ledger. They are producing considerably more carbon than the U.S., although on a per capita basis, they're actually producing less than we are. And as you mentioned, historically, the U.S. has produced far more, and that'll almost certainly always be the case. China will never pass us in terms of historical emissions, which hang in the air for centuries or even millennia. Which is to say, it does actually matter what the U.S. did in the 1950s and the 1850s. It's not just a matter of what we did today and what we'll be doing in 2050. For all those reasons, I think it's a complicated comparison to make. But ultimately, I think that as a country, and as a sort of a national political discourse, we've done too much vilification of China and don't appreciate how much they're doing to accelerate the green transition, not just within their borders, but around the world. They could be doing a lot better. They're still increasing their emissions, whereas we're declining them as our most rich countries in the world. And, you know, that's concerning. But presumably, probably most analysts believe that they'll reach a peak sometime this decade and then we'll start a relatively rapid decline. And at the moment, the fact that other places in the world are driving down their greenhouse gases already is in some meaningful way due to the R&D investment and indeed like cheap industrial production of that green capacity that's happening inside China. And it's not happening. It's not a perfect world. Like, there's a lot of ugly labor practices there. There's a lot of environmental contamination that's happening as a result. But if what we're hoping for is a more urgent global response, I think that the single country that is doing most to accelerate that speed transition is China. They're also doing more to doing more damage than anyone else, but also doing more to bring about resolution of that damage. So again, it's another story where we have to sort of keep two seemingly contradictory points in our heads at once. But I would just urge the listener, and indeed anyone else listening, that, you know, anytime we're really vilifying China, we're probably, you know, we're probably oversimplifying the state of play over there. And maybe also trying to avoid looking at what we are doing here in the United States. Right. And on that point, I mentioned the historical emissions, which are really quite significant. I mean, we are, the US is responsible for something like 20 times as much carbon damage as has been produced by all of sub-Saharan Africa, which is a home to 1.2 billion people. We've done about 20 times as much damage. But even looking at the very present tense, the EPA under Joe Biden recently revised its social cost of carbon, which is a wonky economic way of measuring the amount of damage we expect every ton of carbon to do once we put it into the atmosphere. They revised that upward to, it's $190, but it's in 2019 dollars. So in 2024 dollars, it's something like $220 a ton. And that means that given how much damage, how much carbon we're putting into the atmosphere every year, the Joe Biden EPA believes that this country, the United States, is doing about $1 trillion of damage every year to the planet's climate.
Wow.
That is a really, really large number, and that's the damage that we're doing right now, today. So, we, you know, we may want to point our fingers at China. We may want to shake our fists at them and tell them they're not doing enough. I would like to see China moving more quickly, too. But here we are in a country that is imposing $1 trillion of damage on the world every year, and is also at all-time highs of oil production and gas production and oil exports and gas exports. So even as we are undergoing a pretty rapid transition here, like China, we are also continuing to do a lot of damage. And we should, you know, anytime we're pointing the finger at any other country, you know, probably makes sense to look in the mirror at the same time.
Yeah, I absolutely couldn't agree more. And speaking of listeners, if you are tuning into this, you're listening to Environmental Connections. I'm Jasmine Singer. We're chatting with the incredible David Wallace Wells. David, you terrify and inspire me. I think it's probably true of a lot of people who read your work. If you are listening to this and you are terrified or inspired or something else, feel free to give us a call. I know a few people are already on the line and we will get to you momentarily. 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. If you're local, 263-9994, or you can shoot us an email at connections@wxxi.org. David, one of your central theses is that vast regions of the planet are going to become inhospitable to humans, since large-scale human migrations are apparently inevitable. What should governments, especially ones like Rochester, which may, in fact, in the not-too-distant future, receive hundreds or thousands or even tens of thousands of refugees, be doing to prepare?
Well, you know, there are a few different layers to that question. One is, you know, in an ideal world, how should we be responding? And before we get to the kind of local question, I do think it's important to consider that at a moral level. If it is the case that the US is doing $1 trillion of damage a year, and if it is the case that large portions of the global south, particularly around the equatorial band of the planet, have already suffered something like 20% loss of their GDP, which is what many scientists estimate, those losses are likely to grow. The people feeling pressure in those parts of the world are likely to grow, and they're likely to try to find new places to live that are somewhat more comfortable or hospitable as a result. Many of them are likely to go locally, but others are likely to try to travel around the world to more distant places, in part because those places are wealthier and more prosperous and have more resources and accommodation. And I think ultimately, you know, taking in the full scope of the story, you have to say, you know, people like us are really in a profound way responsible for this crisis. And therefore, we have a really profound responsibility to do what we can to care for and attend to the needs of those who are being hit most intensely. And I think that, you know, that requires something of us at a political level. It means we should be moving fast to decarbonize, because that's one thing we can do. It also means we should be trying to shape our national politics around more generosity and empathy. If climate change teaches us anything, really ultimately it should teach us that we're all on this one planet together and we need to take care of one another. But we're also living in a time where that is, you know, not the message that everyone is learning, or the impulse that everyone is following in responding to, you know, migration flows. I mean, we've seen, not just in the US, but really all around the world over the last decade, a sort of intensification of feelings of xenophobia, resistance to migration, particularly in countries that haven't had a lot of it, but even in countries like the US, where we have a long history of quite generous, relationship with immigrants. At the local level, I think what that means is that, again, it's sort of an echo of what we were talking about earlier in terms of policy action, in terms of decarbonization, which is just to say, like, we are globally seeing a great human migration. We are seeing that at the national level. These are many people who are struggling to get a foothold in a place that is more comfortable and may allow them a more flourishing human life than the one they had elsewhere. Anything that we can do to make that easier and softer on them, I think we should. And that's to say, we should, first of all, say welcome, but also, invest and volunteer in efforts to help those who are relocating relocate. And that can mean, job training, it can mean temporary housing, it can mean any number of things. But I think ultimately it means just adopting a posture of empathy for those who are, dealing with impacts that you and I would be terrified to be dealing with in our own lives, and make dramatic choices to upend their lives, in many ways separate themselves from their families or separate their nuclear families from their extended families. And we should see that as, in certain ways, a gesture of desperation that sort of requires our empathy, but also a gesture of hope that should inspire us to collaborate with them and design a future in which all of us, those who are here already and those who are coming now, can dream of a future of greater prosperity, greater health, greater equality, and greater justice. Not everyone feels those impulses all the time. We're not all perfect beings, but to try to remind ourselves, if we feel thoughts or impulses that are somewhat more negative or hostile, to try to put ourselves in their shoes and respond as we would like to be responded to if we were on the other side.
Do you feel like there are any areas in the U.S. that people should just get out of right now?
Well, personally, I have some of the feelings I think that drove you out of California, which is to say, the prospect of routinely for periods of weeks on end breathing in really quite toxic air from the smoke from wildfire, that really discomforts me. A lot of climate impacts you can imagine on the map. You can sort of plot out the risks. And indeed, that is to some extent true for fire itself, for the direct impact of fire. You can say, I know where my home is. And if the home is in a particular place, you can say, I know that this home is safe. Now, not everybody has that luxury, especially in California. Housing is very expensive. And that means that a lot of people are pushed out into places that have considerably higher wildfire risk than they might like. But nevertheless, you can sort of make a rational assessment of just how at risk you are if you choose to. Smoke is a whole different story. You don't know where the smoke's going to be coming. You don't know how long it's going to last. You can't really choose to be somewhere where you're going to be able to avoid it, as we learned on the East Coast last year. Mm-hmm. It's remarkable to me. I was an East Coaster. I'd never really seen or thought about that sort of orange sky effect that we saw in 2019, 2020 in Australia, and then later in 2020 in the Bay Area and elsewhere in California. And yet I responded to that at an emotional level, at a reflexive level, by thinking, wow, those people in those wildfire states, they're dealing with thank God I'm not dealing with that kind of an impact. Thank God I'm not dealing with smoke at that scale. Thank God I don't have to explain to my 6-year-old daughter, my 3-year-old daughter, why the sun hasn't come up today, which is what some people in California had to do in 2020. I processed it as a problem of the wildfire prone states, but then here we are just a few years later, 2023, and the sky in New York City is orange. Mm-hmm. And I'm taking my mother, who has COPD, to the hospital, and she's, got a face mask on and is having trouble breathing. I mean, this is, these are things that would have struck me as terrifying when I saw it on social media as unfolding elsewhere in the world. And then I would, in a perverse way, sort of tell myself, well, at least it's not happening where I am. But just a few short years later, it was happening where I am. And it's not going to happen every year in New York, and it's actually not going to happen every year in California. But we know we're heading into a future in which many more of those sort of basic pieces of stability that we took for granted in earlier in our lives are simply not, we simply can't count on them in the same way anymore. And we will be able to navigate that. You know, climate change is not the whole of our destiny. It's just the natural landscape on which we'll build a human future. But I think what that tells us is that we need to be really mindful of just how much more jagged that landscape is, how much more challenging it will be, not just to particular communities and particular places, but for almost every community, almost everywhere in the world, and to really, you know, commit time and resources to designing infrastructure, both, you know, hard infrastructure, like literally, you know, roads that don't buckle, dams that don't break, but also human and political infrastructure of care, of empathy that can allow us to navigate that new landscape and still come out on the other side thinking that the kinds of lives that we're living in that future, as pockmarked and disrupted by climate impacts as they may be, are still very much worth living, are still very rewarding, and in fact may look, if we get it all right, may look to people alive in 2075 or 2100, not just normal, but indeed pretty happy and comfortable. Hmm. That opportunity is still on the table. The climate impacts will be real, but you know, the human adaptation could be significant enough to allow us to live happily in that future even so.
Well, we have a caller who has been very patient and has been on the line since pretty much the beginning of the show. So David, are you there? Welcome to Environmental Connections. Thanks so much for your patience. David, are you on the line?
I am.
Yes. Okay. Hi. Thanks so much for calling. You had a question about pollution, I believe, for our guest today, David Wallace Wells.
Well, right. It has to do with business licenses to pollute. And so people can so-called make money polluting, but there's no business license. There's no profit, so to speak, in cleaning it up. And that equation has really terrified the polluters for years, because if they were to, you know, pay the true cost of a cleanup, it might be 20 times more than it cost to pollute in the first place. And to back up your guest's equation on coal, if I remember right, this would have been in the late 80s, that there were subsidies to the coal industry to produce, and it was costing the taxpayers about, I think the true cost was 45 cents a kilowatt hour to produce electricity with coal. And that included digging up a mountain, putting it on a train, taking it 1,000 miles, putting it on a conveyor belt that's going to go into a hopper that's going to help burn it, and then push the electricity 50 miles, and the taxpayer pays all of those subsidies. And at the time, it was, if they looked on their bill, it was usually about 8 cents a kilowatt hour to have electricity in your home.
Yeah.
But the other 35 cents was subsidized in the taxes.
Mm.
And it was worse than making a profit out of polluting. It was paying to pollute. And
right.
It just a terrible economic equation. And
David, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're almost out of time. So can you wrap up real quick? The points you're making are very important, but I just want to make sure that we
well,
can. Yeah.
The right wingers right now are claiming that environmentalists are communists. You know, we're trying to save our lives here.
Right, and, totally.
And they're basically saying that it's against the law to save your life.
Right.
That it's not economically viable to save your life. It's preposterous.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for all of that. I'm sure that you echo a lot of our listeners. David, do you have any response to our caller?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's spot on in many ways. You know, global estimates are that even the direct subsidies to right now to fossil fuels have been over $1 trillion in the last couple of years. And when you account for what economists call the environmental externalities, that is the damages to the environment that pollution is doing and are going unpaid for, you get up to $6-8 trillion a year, which is considerably more than would be necessary to transition away from those fossil fuels into a greener system. So, you know, it's funny, as the listener points out, as the caller points out, you know, this is not actually, you know, we're told that this is like free market at work, but actually if capitalism was working as it should, these investments would be redirected in a completely different way, and we would solve a lot of these problems. To some degree, you know, we're dealing with the stubbornness and the resistance of empowered industries, not, you know, the market working as it should. Mm. The market working as it should would actually have pushed us, I think, to this point, farther along the green transition than we've been to this point. And pollution is, you know, I think it's important to remember that what we're doing when we produce carbon is pollution. It's maybe not as present as the stuff that we have trouble breathing into our lungs, but it is a global damage that we are doing to the planet, and we should be thinking of it in the same way that we thought about the corruption and degradation of clean water and clean air in previous decades and centuries, which were things that really inspired us to take fast action.
Well, David, I have so many more questions for you, but we are running out of time. I'm hoping you can answer this one quickly, though I'm sure it's a big question. Since the book's publication came out, has there been any criticism or feedback that have shaped the way you think? I guess what I'm trying to know is, have you become less pessimistic at all?
I have, although I would say that has more to do with, I think, the way that the world has changed than how the book itself was received. In certain ways, it was a very, propitious time to publish a book of this kind. It was right when, you know, Greta Thunberg was finding her voice and her platform, right when, because of this big UN report, there was a lot more concern about climate change, and there was an awakening of climate action. Because of that action, I think the future looks considerably less bleak than 5 years ago. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. It's still darker than it will be today and still darker than we want it to be, but we're moving much faster than we thought, and that's frankly thrilling.
David Wallace Wells, there are so many more questions I could ask you, but thank you so much for your insights and for sharing your perspectives today. I can't thank you enough. And for our listeners that we didn't get to, just remember that David is going to be a guest at Monroe Community College on May 1st at 7 p.m. And tickets are available for the general public at MCC's website. WXXI is a media sponsor. Thank you so much. I'm Jasmine Singer. We appreciate you making these environmental connections.